welcome to Your Turn. Mike Fauzi here. Glad to have you with us. Delighted to be back. And we're going to have an interesting show today. We're going to bring in the signs of the zodiac to a certain extent. And talking about the ones who rule. In this case, it's Leos. And it's maybe not the Leo you think. Our producer, Julia Ziegler. Julia, she's a Leo, but she's not the kind of Leo we're talking about today. Tell us what a Leo is in federal language. And I'm speaking, of course, with John Grobe. He is president of Federal Career Experts, and you guys do training all over the country for federal agencies, mid-career retirement training and that sort of thing.
Yes, we do, and we do a lot for agencies with law enforcement officers, and that, of course, is what a Leo is. A Leo is called, along with firefighters and air traffic controllers, a special category employee. There's extra stress and extra physical demands in those jobs, so there are some significant differences in the retirement of a law enforcement officer, firefighter, or air traffic controller than there is from an accountant, purchasing agent, or human resources specialist.
You don't see many old Leos floating around, do you?
You don't. They have to leave at the age of 57. They must be, unless they have an exemption from their agency head, they must be off the rolls by the end of the month in which they turn the age of 57.
And you said air traffic controllers, firefighters are part of this, the Leo community. Do you know how many people are in the Leo designation?
You know,
I mean, it's got to be hundreds of thousands.
I would think so. This is nothing other than a wild guess, maybe 150,000, 175,000.
Okay. Right, and you can understand why air traffic controllers, I've been in centers and flight service stations, and it's the kind of thing where there may be hours of boredom and then seconds or minutes of absolute terror and, you know, heart-stopping things. And, of course, law enforcement people encounter this all the time in their jobs. You know, wait, and then boom.
Yeah, and believe it or not, the air traffic controllers, with their job being perhaps more stressful, have a mandatory age of 56, as opposed to the law enforcement and federal firefighters who have that mandatory age of 57.
Okay, now, I seem to remember from the ancient past that the average federal worker retires about age 61 or 62. It tends to be younger than in the private sector, but that's 3 or 4 years longer. Of course, those averages cover a lot of things. But how do you make ends meet when you're forced to retire at age 56 or 57?
Well, frankly, a lot of law enforcement officers choose to retire at an age younger than 56 or 57.
Okay.
A lot of them will do so if they can, if they have enough time or enough age after 20 years of service. Mm-hmm. In the computation for their pension, they get a benefit that is good for 20 years of qualifying law enforcement time, but it's not good after that. Let me just give a quick example. We have a law enforcement officer who hired on at the age of 25.
Yeah.
They have 20 years of qualifying law enforcement service. That makes them 45. Those 20 years, each one of those years is worth, under FERS, 1.7% of their high three. While for your purchasing agent or accountant, their years are worth 1% times their high three, unless they are age 62 or older when they retire. In that case, it's 1.1. But after a law enforcement officer puts in their 20 years, all subsequent years are going to be worth 1%. So going back to my law enforcement officer, that person has, they started at the age of 25. They have their 20 years of qualifying service in at 45. At age 50, they've got 25 years in. Each additional year is worth 1%. They seriously think about leaving at that time.
Because a lot of those people, they have particular skills, particularly in the investigative area, in security, and they've got usually top secret or very high level security clearances. So they're a real, plus their own health insurance. So they're a bargain to the private sector, aren't they?
They absolutely are, and that's what a lot of law enforcement officers do. They go into private security at different mm-hmm. levels.
Well, now I've known several FBI agents, known two DEA agents, and I think somebody that worked for the Secret Service, and they all started out as policemen, some in your hometown of Chicago, actually one, but they start out as policemen in a local jurisdiction. Does that time count toward their federal service?
That would not count towards their federal service, any state or local time, but you're absolutely right. Many people who are current law enforcement officers were municipal or state police for a period of time before they became a federal law enforcement officer.
Okay. Can you sort of, in a nutshell, explain the difference between regular civil service retirement, I guess for most people now that's FERS, Federal Employees Retirement System, between that and the LEOs? And I you did give the percentage that people earn, but more than that?
Yeah, there are several differences. Of course, there is, we mentioned it earlier, the mandatory retirement.
Right.
And that's because of a provision in the law. They state that law enforcement officers and firefighters must be young and vigorous. And I suppose 57 is younger and more vigorous than either you or I, but it's
looks
not
good to me. Yeah,
it's not necessarily younger or more vigorous than someone in their 20s or 30s. So a law enforcement officer, a firefighter, or an air traffic controller can retire earlier than a regular federal employee. If I'm a regular FERS employee, I'll be able to retire at my minimum retirement age, which for most people is 56 or 57, with 30 years of service. Now, not everyone has 30 years of service. If I came to the federal government in the middle of my career, I would be able to retire at the age of 60 with 20 years of service. Or if I came to the federal government at any time after the age of 42, I would be able to retire at the age of 62 as long as I had at least 5 years of service. But a LEO, they can retire under FERS at the age of 50 with 20 years of qualifying law enforcement service. That's basically service where you are in the law enforcement occupation. For example, if you're a criminal investigator, you're in the 1811 mm-hmm. series. A law enforcement officer could also retire at any age as long as they had 25 years of qualifying service. So if you have someone who was hired right out of college into a federal law enforcement job, they got their first law enforcement job at the age of 22, 25 years is 47. You could have a law enforcement officer eligible for retirement at the age of 47.
Okay, and as you say, pointed out, many do that because they are such a hot commodity in the private sector.
Absolutely. They're a hot commodity. Their pension is not, after the first 20 years of qualifying service, not growing any faster than a regular employee's pension. So you see a lot of people doing that. Their pension, though, they have to contribute more for their pension than a regular employee, a regular FERS employee. And right now, I'll just talk about who I'm sure are the bulk of our listeners, mm-hmm. people who were hired before the 1st of January 2013 when they started increasing contributions. A regular FERS employee hired before 1/1/13 is kicking in 0.8% of their salary towards their FERS pension. A FERS LEO hired before 1/1/2013 has to contribute 0.5% more, or 1.3%. Uncle Sam, of course, contributes a significantly higher amount in FERS than employees contribute. So they have to pay more money, and they also have something that, going back to my days, we used to call it administratively uncontrollable overtime.
I wanted to ask you about that. We need to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Be right back talking with John Grobe. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with John Grobe. He is president of Federal Career Experts, and their firm goes around the country and teaches pre-retirement seminars and various things to different federal agencies. And John, you mentioned when we were talking about this show, that about half of your seminars now are aimed at the law enforcement community. And I guess it's indicative of a couple of things. One is budget cuts by agencies for training and that sort of thing. And the other is the importance that law enforcement agencies, you know, Homeland Security, Secret Service, Park Police, what have you, and the air traffic controllers and the firefighters, but the importance they place in keeping their employees informed and happy, right? And one of the ways to do that is to explain their benefits.
And I would agree with that. And in addition, because the law enforcement benefits are different, they want to bring in someone, the agencies do, who knows the law enforcement retirement. And they don't want someone, a law enforcement officer, being taught about how regular FERS is. That would be depressing if you were a Leo.
Yeah, if you had to leave at age 56 or 57, And I guess, too, hearing it from an outside expert as opposed to somebody in-house who might be tempted, or people might think they'd be tempted to paint a rosier picture than it really is.
And with retirement in general in the federal agencies, you've seen retirement advice and processing very often being centralized in one location for the whole agency.
Yep.
No longer can someone walk up to their personnel office and talk to a live retirement specialist. It's generally done off-site, and there's no on-site expertise in many of the agencies.
That's one of the downsides of the Clinton administration. When they got rid of the 274,000 federal workers, one of the groups they concentrated on outsourcing was in HR and that sort of thing. So whereas, as you said, people once had an HR office in their building, now it may be in another city even, but the need for outside experts is greater than ever.
I think so, and I think that's true not just with law enforcement retirement, but with other retirement. But getting back into the FERS law enforcement, let's just take a look at a pension of someone who retired with 20 years of service. If I were a FERS law enforcement officer and had the age requirement when I had 20 years of service, my pension would be 34% of my high three. If I were a regular FERS employee retiring with 20 years of service and retiring at an age under the age of 62, my pension would be but 20% of my high three. If I'm that same non-Leo FERS person with 20 years of service and I happen to retire at the age of 62 or older, my pension would be 22%. So that's quite a bump there for law enforcement officers to encourage them to retire early as
well. Well, the other thing, too, this when they set up the FERS retirement system in the 1980s, they gave people the option to invest in the Thrift Savings Plan, a federal 401k, and as a sweetener, a big sweetener, the government would put in 5% for FERS employees who put in 5% of their own. But that's a lifetime 5% tax deferred pay raise, big deal. But it's sort of mandatory for people under the FERS system because it's a three-legged stool. It's a civil service retirement, Social Security, and then whatever you earn from the Thrift Savings Plan. And I know when it was set up, the estimates were that the money from the Thrift Savings Plan would provide anywhere from one-third to one-half of the total income that FERS employees had to spend in retirement, obviously depending on how much they invest, how the stock market does. But that's a critical component, is it not?
It is very critical. I always hate to use three-legged stool because I always assumed that the legs of a stool should
Good
be
point.
Of equal length.
Good point.
I just like to call it a triangle.
Yeah.
And what we're looking for, I will call it a retirement income triangle. There's a kind of general rule of thumb that financial planners use, and that is you should strive to have retirement income that is equal to 80% of your pre-retirement gross.
Yeah.
So you're looking at, let's say I'm a Leo that left with 20 years of service. I've got 34% of my high three. I've got a little more than a third of it. Maybe I work 25 years if I'm a Leo. I've got 39%. Social Security's replacement rate for someone who is highly compensated, as most federal LEOs are, is somewhere in the low 20% range. So I'm still falling, somewhere in the vicinity of 20% short of my goal of 80% of my pre-retirement gross. And that's where the TSP comes in. It's too important to ignore the TSP. It's incredibly important. And law enforcement officers just got a little break dealing with the TSP. It deals with the early withdrawal penalty, a bill that was snuck through with the trade bill, H.R. 2164. It's going to be effective the first of next January, allows a federal law enforcement officer to make a penalty-free withdrawal from their thrift if they retire in the year in which they turn 50 or later. It used to be that federal law enforcement officers and other special category employees had the same rules that a regular FERS employee does. And the rule on the thrift savings plan for early withdrawal penalties for regular employees is they would have to retire in the year in which they turned 55 or later to avoid that early withdrawal penalty. So this is a big deal for law enforcement officers who are going to be retiring somewhere between the year in which they turn 50 and the year in which they turn 55. They now have penalty-free access to the thrift earlier.
And otherwise, and currently, the penalty is in the 20 to 30% range, isn't it? I mean, it's a stiff one.
You've got your tax and you've got your 10% early withdrawal penalty.
So whatever your tax rate is.
Yeah. So you're hit with that.
It could be almost half of the money you're withdrawing, depending on your tax bracket.
Depending on the bracket, yeah. It's something that organizations like FLIOA, the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, have been pushing for a long, long time, and it finally came through. So we might want to mark this day as the day when Congress did something good for federal employees.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It sure has been.
You know, in the government, we're full of initials and anachronisms and whatnot. We're talking about LEOs, not Leo the Lion, not Julia Ziegler's sign in the Zodiac, but a Leo the Lion. In the federal government, stands for law enforcement officer, which, as you said, also includes federal firefighters and air traffic controllers. You mentioned something earlier, and the initial popped up in my head, AUO.
Yes, administratively uncontrollable overtime, also known these days as law enforcement availability pay.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, law enforcement officers have to be available when they're needed. If I am in a van outside of a drug kingpin's house taping some deal and 4:30 comes around, I'm not going to walk out of the back of the van in my bright yellow blazer and go to the bus stop.
Yeah.
So federal law enforcement officers get a percentage of their salary added in as AUO, or law enforcement availability pay. That percentage could be as high as 25%. So they're dealing not only with an enhanced computation, the 1.7% for the first 20 years of qualifying service, but they're dealing with a high 3 salary that is enhanced by the administratively uncontrollable overtime. So they're getting a higher percentage of a higher salary.
Okay, so I'm on a stakeout, and you know my shift ends at 5 o'clock. As you say, I don't exit the van with my police vest and catch the bus. If I stay there 10 hours, that's already built in as part of this.
It's already built in as part of the AUO. Yes, you may end up working a lot of AUO in 1 year, you may end up working less the next, but it's built into the high 3 salary.
So I suppose most Leos keep their cell phones on all the time. I mean, that's part of the job.
And you'd be surprised at how many of them are wearing their firearms all the time, because they need to be ready at a moment's notice to do whatever they're called to do.
Yeah, I know with one particular force, which I won't mention because I'm not 100% sure of it, but they are required to carry at mm-hmm. all times. They're part of the protection. We're talking before about, and maybe contrast the regular FERS with the LEO's FERS and the regular civil service with the LEO's. But and you mentioned the penalty-free withdrawal, and said that was snuck in as part of the trade bill, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to ask you about that after we take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with John Grove. He is president of Federal Career Experts, and his firm travels around the country talking at different federal agencies under contract, and they brief employees. A lot of this is mid-career or pre-retirement sort of thing, John, right?
Yes, absolutely. Most agencies will try and provide some type of retirement briefing for people within 5 years of retirement, and others have expanded it to people in the middle of their career. Because if I were at the end of my career and no one had ever told me how important the TSP was, and I'm sitting there 5 years out,
yeah.
I would say, well, gee, why didn't you tell me this a long time ago?
Yeah.
The TSP is so important that for all of you seasoned employees out there, do yourself and your coworkers a favor. Walk up to that kid that was hired on Monday mm-hmm. and tell them how important it is to put money in the TSP.
Yeah, yeah. When you're 50 years old and you start saving, it takes a lot longer for the compounding is something that works over time. John, a lot of initials and anachronisms in the federal thing. And we got an email question from Paul G. And it just says, LEO unfair pay cap limits and LEAP. Here we go, another one, L-E-A-P.
LEAP is law enforcement availability pay,
okay,
which is similar to the administratively uncontrollable overtime.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, law enforcement officers, like everyone else, their high three is limited by the pay cap, which, because my salary never approached it, I never paid much attention to,
mm-hmm.
but I believe it's around $155,000 and something now. So, you know, all federal employees are going to be limited by the pay cap.
Right. If you're if you're GS-15, if you're in a lot of cities, Washington, Houston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York,
mm-hmm.
You're bumped up against that cap, and you may be a step 8 of the grade, but you're paid the same as somebody at the 10th step of that grade. So the cap keeps it keeps moving down.
And it's more likely to affect someone who is highly compensated, such as a law enforcement
yeah.
officer, than it would be to affect other people.
Good point. Okay. And when we were, again, talking about this show, you said you wanted to make the point about there's no earnings test on the FERS supplement until MRA. Again, another one, MRA, minimum retirement age. But what is this FERS supplement all about? I think a lot of people don't understand it, and it is a vital component of the FERS retirement system.
It is. OPM officially calls it the Retiree Annuity Statement Supplement, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
But the best description I ever heard was someone who called it the Social Security Bridge Payment.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it comes from Social Security, but it's a payment that is available to FERS retirees from their minimum retirement age until they reach the age of 62. Now, that's a regular FERS retiree. Mm-hmm. A law enforcement officer becomes eligible to receive this supplemental payment when they retire. So if I'm a law enforcement officer or a firefighter or an air traffic controller and I am retiring at the age of 50, I begin to earn that supplement at 50. I don't have to wait to my minimum retirement age like a regular FERS employee.
Right, and you'll get that for 12 years until your 62nd birthday.
Yes.
And, you know, the thing about that, again, is I think so many people that flies under the radar, but that can be a big chunk of change. That can be $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, maybe even more for some people.
Over the course of a year, yes, I would think so. And another benefit for the FERS law enforcement officers is with that supplement, any of the payments they receive up until they reach their MRA are not subject to the annual earnings test that applies to the supplement. The earnings test that applies to the supplement is the same as the Social Security earnings test. For example, this year, for every $2 I earned above $15,720, my supplement would be reduced by $1. So if I'm retiring at 50 and I'm a Leo, I've got 6, maybe 7 years where I can earn absolutely as much as I want and still collect my supplement.
Big deal.
It is a big deal, yes.
One thing, we were talking earlier about the advantage of having these seminars such as you conduct for educating employees, but I would think this is a real advantage to the federal agency. You know, every federal agency says it wants the best people, wants to recruit the best and brightest and keep them. And if somebody is, particularly with the new generation where the people jump jobs a lot, it's considered par for the course. But if you realize early on in your federal career that you have all these perks waiting for you at the end of the line, all of these benefits, a guaranteed COLA, a cost of living adjustment, an inflation-free or inflation-protected pension, that's a huge deal. The value of the thrift savings plan, making your maximum contributions, as you said, a huge deal. And I would think if you catch somebody in the first year or two of employment and you know, shake them by the lapels and say, hey, this is a very good deal. Look at what's happening in the private sector to pensions and that sort of thing, and look at what the government offers you. And I would think that would be a real retention device.
I would think it would be, too. Unless you were in an occupation where you would find a private sector employer willing to pay you many multiples of your federal salary. But our benefits are really good. And you mentioned the cost of living adjustment.
Yeah.
And there's another difference between retirement for a regular FERS employee and retirement for a federal law enforcement officer, firefighter, or air traffic controller. If I am a regular FERS employee, I will not begin earning my cost of living adjustment until I reach the age of 62.
Oh, correct, yeah.
So if I retire at, let's just say my minimum retirement age is 57, I've got 5 years of no inflation protection on my pension. Now, if I'm a law enforcement officer, I am going to be earning that COLA literally from the minute I retire. If I retire at 50, I've got a COLA on my FERS pension for 12 years, where FERS employee would not. And depending on the rate of inflation, if inflation averaged 3%, that would be worth roughly 24% additional pension. That's using huge. The rule of 72 there.
That's huge. Yeah, well, I remember when I was at the Washington Post doing the Federal Diary column, I decided one time I was going to compare post benefits, our own benefits package, to the federal government. And, of course, the federal government has the cost of living adjustment, COLA, which is practically unknown in the private sector. And if you're a civil service retirement type, you get a full COLA. If you're a FERS employee, you get a COLA minus 1% over a certain level. But it's still something, and it still really keeps you on par with inflation. Anyhow, bottom line, I called our HR office at the Post, and I said, when is the last time Washington Post retirees got a COLA? And she said, what's a COLA? There's your answer. And the private sector, check with the Employee Benefits Research Institute and other places that track these things and know these things. And again, they'll say retirement plans are disappearing. They're like the buffalo back in the day. They're disappearing. COLAs are practically unknown in the private sector. And this employer match that you mentioned earlier, the 5% that federal workers under the FERS system can get from the government is also unknown. So it's a very good package.
Yeah, the match on the TSP is very generous compared with private sector matches, your average private sector match. And not every private sector 401k has one, but your average one is significantly less than what we get in the TSP. But mentioning COLAs, that's probably another thing we should talk about with the Thrift Savings Plan. We get a COLA on our pension. If we're entitled to Social Security, we get a COLA on our Social Security. We do not get a COLA with the Thrift Savings Plan. People who are taking money out of the Thrift Savings Plan need to be able to plan their withdrawals so that they can give themselves a COLA as they are withdrawing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one reason that so many financial planners, you know, when a lot of people retire, they put all of their money in the G fund, the Treasury Securities Fund, thinking it's safe, which it is. You know, it's financially safe, but the growth is minuscule. And over time, inflation will eat into that unless people have some investment in the CS or I funds, the stock market funds. And, you know, you obviously take more risk, but there's also more reward.
And that, I think, is why the TSP came out with those life cycle funds,
yeah.
The L funds,
yeah.
Back when they did. If you look in a normal year, you will see the most cautious of the L funds getting a return significantly better than the G fund. Of course, there's always the exception that proves the rule.
Sure.
You look at 2008, where the G fund made about 3.75,
mm-hmm.
and the L income fund dropped pretty close to 6%, almost 6. Now, that's still not as bad as being in the individual stock funds was at that time. And you still, in the L income fund, do have 20% of your money in those stock funds. There's 74% of the money in G, 6% in F, and the remaining 20% is in the stock funds, with more than half of that stock amount being in the C fund. In addition, things have popped up recently, TSP allocation services. Some of them they're generally subscription services. Some of them use proprietary information, which means I don't understand how it works, and I guess I'm not supposed to. And there are others that literally follow moving averages of the stock market. For example, one called TSP Safety Net will follow a 40-week moving average. And if one of the fund's performance dips below that average, it will result in a suggestion that you move out of that fund into something that is doing better.
Yeah.
So you have some of those subscription services out there, too. But inflation is a big, big enemy in the TSP.
Well, most of the pros that I've talked with who don't sell their own services, though. They don't want a piece of your TSP. But most of them say, you know, stay the course. Don't try to time the market, and kind of beware of things like this that say, here's a trend. Maybe you should shift mm-hmm. out of it, because then you are unwittingly your market timing.
I guess you would be doing that,
yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. Well, another interesting point you made about the life cycle funds. And I want to ask you about that after our break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, Mike Causey, glad to have you here on the last leg of your turn. I'm talking with John Grobe. He is president of Federal Career Experts. We're talking during the break, and this is the first time John's been on the show because he's on the road a lot, but not necessarily in the D.C. area. But we're going to get him back. And today we're looking at LEOs, law enforcement officers, and the special retirement program and other benefits that are available to not only law enforcement officers, but federal firefighters and air traffic controllers, people in high-stress jobs, and learned a lot and a lot of differences between the LEOs and other heads. John, we were talking about the threats, if you will, that are facing the federal workforce. And here at Federal News Radio, we try very hard not to hype things. I mean, you know, the sky is falling in, the Chicken Little syndrome. We try to avoid that. At the same time, you want to inform people that there is a potential threat out there. There may be a tornado. There may be a hurricane coming. So batten down the hatches. Don't worry too much, but batten down the hatches. Some of these have been around forever. But you were, and I'd like to have your assessment of some of these. A, what are these, quote, threats? B, how likely are they to happen? And starting with the so-called chained CPI, it's a difficult concept to understand, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics measures inflation, complicated process, and they go city by city, and then they come up with a chart showing the inflation rate, and then federal annuities and Social Security benefits are adjusted accordingly. But some people think that the system they use now, the one of the many consumer price indexes they use now, overstates inflation because it doesn't take into account the fact that if the price of coffee goes up, people may switch to tea, or if the example is steak to hamburger to chicken, and it doesn't take into account. Opponents of that system say, yeah, but eventually the steak to chicken to hamburger is going to have us eating dog food, so that's not fair. But the bottom line is, using this chained CPI, it's been estimated, I think, that it would reduce the average annual future increase in cost of living adjustments by something like 0.3%. Not a whole lot, but over time, as you pointed out, the miracle of compounding works both ways. You can lose as well as win. All of the retiree groups and many of the federal and postal unions say that this is the number one threat facing federal workers. Would you agree, and what's your assessment of its chances?
I think I would agree with them, because this looked like it was going to happen a couple of years ago. If you go back to 2013, you would see that the White House budget called for a chained CPI, a switch. The House of Representatives budget, in other words, the sworn enemies, They both agreed on something, and that was going to a chained CPI, plus the Simpson-Bowles report, which is gathering dust somewhere, called for a chained CPI. Well, it never happened, even though everybody seemed to want it to happen. And I think that goes back to an old saying, decades old, and that saying is, Social Security is the third rail of American politics, because a chained CPI would not just affect our federal pensions, both CSRS and FERS, but it would affect Social Security, which is an integral part of your FERS retirees' income. But overall, there are close to 64 million Social Security recipients, and I think all the politicians who wanted the chained CPI just started counting votes. Even if I were a congressperson in a totally safe district, totally safe for my party, that would not stop someone from running against me in the primary, looking at me, pointing their finger at me, and saying, take a good look, folks, that's the guy who voted to cut your Social Security. So I think there's you might call it a lot of fear. You might call it a lack of political will. Now, even if I were to look at a worst-case scenario that something actually happened, let's go back almost 30 years ago to when FERS came into being. Every single current employee, anyone on the rolls on 12/31/83, was grandfathered into the CSRS system. So I think even if there were some of these changes, I think current employees would be grandfathered in. And I think the best advice is, anytime there's a threat, the words "don't panic" should be put somewhere near it. I really don't think there's any cause for panic.
Yeah, because some of these threats, and while they're very real, they are threats only, and some of them have literally been around for 30 years. There are people listening to this show who can't remember a time when that particular benefit wasn't under siege.
I first heard of the threat to switch to the high five from the high three when I was a 25-year-old mailman. Yeah, one of my first federal jobs. My hair was a lot darker than it is now. There was a lot more of it, and they were still threatening to go to a high five, and it hasn't happened yet.
Well, and the irony of that, many people have pointed it out, but they don't like to say it in public because it angers some federal workers. But of all of the threats facing federal workers on the job front, the benefits package, that's probably the least intrusive, switching from high three to a high five. You know, we were under a high five system for many years. The high three is the exception. But I've seen someone who said you could work an extra few months under in the federal civil service and negate the difference between the high three and the high five.
That was certainly true if we go back a few years ago and look at that three-year pay freeze that our federal employees had to suffer.
Yeah.
That was much more damaging to them than any switch from a high three to a high five would have been. It, in effect, froze everyone's high three for the entire three-year period.
Yeah, very a draconian measure. And the White House proposed a two-year freeze, as I recall it. Congress extended it to three. The Simpson-Bowles Commission that you pointed out that was a White House creature, it, I think, proposed a three-year freeze.
It did.
It saved a huge amount of money. And anytime the government saves money at the expense of federal employees and postal workers, that means they lose that much in income.
Indeed. And who are the job creators? My own personal opinion is the job creator is the person who takes his money and goes out and buys something.
Yeah.
That if people can spend their income, they're going to be the ones that get the economy moving, that get the companies hiring and so on.
Okay. John Grobe, thank you so much for being here. We're going to have you back, and we look forward to you all joining us again next Wednesday at 10 a.m., so have a good week.